brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here. We're going to dive straight into a bit of preamble and a report of a game that I played recently with Robert. It was a game of Planet 28, and we played a kind of adapted scenario from the sci-fi skirmish scenarios book, which I talk about quite a lot on this show. So let's get straight into it then. You'll hear about the setup, you'll hear about some of the wee tweaks we made to various rules and the scenario itself, and then you'll hear the post-mortem as well and hear how it all went. Let's go. So what we've got here is a pretty standard derelict sci-fi world.
Yeah.
And you'll see that there's a lot of built-up terrain around the edge of the table, but then in the middle we've got like crates and barrels and stuff like that. And it's quite an exposed area. So the objective for these two warbands, what you've got, again, I like to do this, bad guys and good guys. The good guys are probably not very good. The bad guys are probably quite bad, though. So the bad guys are like a kind of undead style warband. There's a couple of like skeleton space marine type guys. Guy with a staff who's potentially a necromancer and a magic user as well, who's floating about there. He's either coming back from the bar with two like snowballs, or it's kind of like magic in his hands, maybe wee fireballs, punitive fireballs. Draw your own conclusions.
Oh yeah, he may be doing the thriller dance. He's got his hands in the kind of, like he's got the reins of a horse a little bit, and he's about to start doing that skippy knee thing.
And he's making the noise, the neighing noise.
Yeah.
My daughter actually does that. but then she's two and not a miniature. On the so-called good guys side, just some like mercenary grunt type guys led by, see the guy with the big coat on? He's him.
Oh yeah, Decker from Blade Runner.
I called him Agent Jake Ett because he's got his Jake on. So the aim of this is to get one of your miniatures to the objective, those crates.
Yeah.
There's some sort of artifact in there, okay? And, I'll let you know in a second what that might be about. But the objective is to get one of your guys next to that pile of crates and have them there as the game ends. There's a couple of wee caveats to this too, but there's also a couple of NPCs, not player characters, non-player characters, isn't it? I say a couple, there's four of them. So up here, there's two little like undead classic 1950s aliens, and you've got two of them down in that corner as well. These are just something I've added in to mix things up a bit, because with us being in cover and shooting at each other, it would be easy just to find a good spot and remain there. But with these wee guys kicking about, it maybe means that, you know, sitting in the same place for too long is going to attract some unwanted attention. So these wee guys will be coming after us as well. What I was thinking for them, again, just flying by the seat of my pants here, is that they only have one wound. So if you kill them, they're removed. But they could maybe just then re-enter the table, like it would be a different one in terms of the story. They would just reappear on the table, maybe the nearest edge of the table to where they were killed, if that makes sense.
So they'll just keep coming then?
Yeah, so they respawn. So
yeah,
although you might want to kill one to get them off your back, you know that you can't, there's no point in spending time killing these guys because they're just going to keep coming.
Yeah, so I did wonder when you were saying that before, that would I just go and hide well out of sight of you, wait for the guy to come close, you know, the NPC, the Jeopardy one, and take him out, and it's like, right, I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they keep coming. So, yeah, one wound, they're pretty low level, they'll maybe do a bit of damage eventually to you if they get up to you. They can't shoot, so they're just going to be getting a bit scratchy or bitey.
Yeah.
Doing what undead things do. So yeah, with this being like a kind of derelict sci-fi world, you've got essentially an undead warband, or partly undead warband. So, I mean, you might imagine this is in those crates, there's some sort of artifact that if the bad guys got hold of it, they could control all the undead in this world. Whereas if the good guys got it, they could destroy all the undead in this world. So,
aye.
You know, just a pretty standard sci-fi shootout with a wee bit of story underneath.
Okie dokie.
Oh, so this game, you might remember this, that the turn sequence, it wasn't you go, I go. It was a case of each miniature, each character had an agility, and that determined how soon they moved.
Yeah.
But I didn't really want these warbands to have massive differences in their quality. So they are pretty similar, with a couple of exceptions. So what I've done instead, there's a deck of cards there.
Yeah.
I've taken a lead from Frostgrave or Rangers of Shadowdeep. So each of our characters has their own card assigned to them. So we'll essentially just work our way through that deck and it'll be entirely random. So
right, okay.
You'll draw a card, you'll see, you know, it'll be one of your guys or one of my guys, and then we'll just move them and we'll work our way through the deck. When we get to, again, this is something I've come up with, when we get to the Joker card, all of the aliens will move and that'll be them for that turn.
Right, okay.
Or all of the aliens will act. And like our players, they'll get two activations each as well. We always get two activations. Abilities wise, we didn't use much of these the last time, or did we? So in terms of the abilities, I could remember we used a few of the abilities when we were playing Brutal Quest, but the throw one we forgot about, didn't we?
Yeah, just picking somebody up and throwing them away.
So I've actually, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I copied the rulebook into ChatGPT and asked it to come out with loads more potential traits and abilities. Obviously, you get a lot of junk when you do that, but you get a few of them that are decent and you could kind of tweak them a wee bit. There's one at the top, Distract.
Distract. Once per game, this character can use an action to create a distraction. All enemy characters within line of sight, if partial cover roll d6, 1 to 3 are affected, 4 to 6 not affected. But all enemy characters otherwise within line of sight must pass an awareness skill roll or become distracted and miss the next turn. Tactician. Once per game, this character can provide tactical advice to a friendly character within line of sight. The chosen character gains a +2 bonus to their next action. That's quite cool. Chain Lightning. This powerful spell allows the caster to release a bolt of lightning that arcs between multiple targets. Make a P roll. Is that perception?
Yeah. Psych, sorry.
Oh, yeah, of course. Psych. If successful with the psych roll, choose a starting target within 30 centimeters range and line of sight. The lightning then jumps to the nearest enemy within 10 centimeters, dealing 2d6 +2, that's quite good.
That's your man that looks like he's on an invisible horse.
Yeah, that's going to be an average of like 8 damage. Repeat this process until there are no eligible targets or you fail the psych roll. Very nice. Aimed Shot. This character may use an action to aim their weapon at an enemy's weak spot. Their weapon does an additional 1d8 damage in their next attack this turn.
I'm not sure if that was one of the default ones from the book or if that's one that
was
created. But we've got Vengeful there.
Vengeful. When this character takes damage from an enemy, they gain +1 F and +1 S. What's that, fight and shoot or something?
Yeah, exactly. So fight being melee.
Yeah. For the remainder of the game. Yeah, let me read that again. Vengeful, when they take damage from an enemy, they gain +1 fight, +1 shoot for the remainder of the game versus that enemy up to a maximum of +3 each. Applies to one enemy only.
Yeah, so you could get a character that's pretty strong in the end against a specific character who's wronged them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Cool, so that is some little abilities that hopefully we remember to use and get some use out of. One other thing that we were forgetting to do in the last game that's relevant or useful is pushing back on, like, it hand-to-hand will maybe be less common in this game, given that everyone's got guns.
Yeah.
But if you get into melee combat, you can get a bit bogged down, can't you? You end up with folk kind of glued together. So
yeah,
if you win the combat, even if you don't inflict damage, you can push the character back a couple of centimetres. So as long as you remember that, it means that, you know, folk aren't basically getting glued in.
Yeah, that's good.
So it's pretty handy. I think that's it, though. I think that was all there was to go over. We'll have a wee bash at it, see how it goes. Yeah. Oh, there's one more thing, actually. One more thing. I talked about the fact that if you... I mean, the objective is to end the game with one of your characters unopposed by the enemy, and you're beside those crates. You're touching the crate or the barrel. You've got base contact with it, basically.
Yeah.
So if this was just a standard six-turn game, you could obviously be a bit tactical about it and just hold folk in reserve and then just make a run for it on the last turn and hope for the best. But there's a pretty cool way around this. I'm going to show you the page of the book just now. That's the Sci-Fi Skirmish Scenarios book that we're using. This scenario is called Strut Your Stuff. So on the game length section, if you read that.
Okay, game length. Introduce randomization for the exact length of the game to preclude chess-like predictability of the end game. At the end of GL-1.
So that's basically game length is like what it would be. So let's say six turns. So he's referring to the fifth turn here.
Yeah. So let's say at the end of the fifth turn, roll a die. On a 1 or 2, the game ends immediately. On a 3 or 4, it ends on the next turn. And on a 5 or 6, it ends after one additional turn. Interesting. So when we get to turn 5...
It might just be over.
It might end.
Or, yeah, it might not.
So it gives you that kind of, no. The bus might leave early, eh? We better get there.
So there we go. Nothing else to do but get to it and roll some dice, I suppose. Smash some skulls, stomp all over you.
Yeah.
So we got to the end of turn 5 there, Robert. It was already looking pretty bleak for me. Only 2 guys left on the table. You've got one of your guys at the objective, and then we had to do the old roll. So what did we roll to see if the game continued or not?
It was 1 or 2 to end early at the end of turn 5, 3 or 4 for, like, well, normal would be like the end of
one
turn
more
6.
Turn, yeah.
5 or 6 would have extended it by a turn. And we rolled a 2, which meant it ended here and now with Mr. Pineapple, aka Grudge, standing next to the barrels and crates.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't go very well for me, partly down to my own stupidity, but I think you got into better positions earlier. I was kind of... I wasn't very sure what I was doing. I was skirting around the edges.
Yeah.
I made a real blunder. So Scully, he's probably my most powerful character. And I went charging into that alien needlessly. And he, like, even though they're not particularly strong characters, the alien NPCs, the zombies, he gave me a fair old headbutt and nearly killed me. I had to take a break test, and if I'd failed that, I was right on the edge of the table. That would have been him away.
Yeah.
But
that was interesting. I didn't realise that the aliens actually had 2d6 melee damage, you know, like, so it was like, oh, if they do hit, it's going to hurt.
Yeah,
lot,
like, they're easy to kill. They're easy to get away from. They're easy to kill, but you don't want to get bitten by one. So, I mean, they livened up. They prevented us from just staying in the same positions.
Yeah.
It becomes then just a dice rolling exercise. Like, there's no point in even having miniatures on the table. So it was good that they helped keep things moving.
Yeah, because initially I'd split my guys. 2 went one way, 3 another. And the forces, you know, was it 2 of them I had or 3? 3 of them were over the far side of the table from where I am. And I realised I was going to have 2 aliens right behind me, as well as your guys skirting towards me. So kind of a 2 of them abandoned, what's his name? Slinger, the Mohawk guy, and ran over. So I concentrated on the side nearest me and just left Slinger up there to kind of just run interference, basically. And I concentrated more on my side of the table, which worked out for me anyway.
One thing we did adjust on the fly early on was the range, wasn't it? So
yeah,
you had two sets of, so the lighter guns, they had a range of 12 centimetres and the heavier guns had a range of 30. And what we found was that it just wasn't very far, was it? And you could actually have been in the position where you could have had somebody on the objective in the middle of the table. And even though a lot of folk would have line of sight on them, they didn't have the range. So we just extended that, didn't we? We said 60 yeah. centimetres and 24 centimetres.
Yeah, because otherwise, if you can move 20 centimetres in one turn, but you can only shoot 12, you could effectively outrun somebody's blast, if
mm-hmm.
you like.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, doesn't really translate into real terms, but it was like, yeah, they, it just needs to be a little bit further.
And then having that range, I mean, half of the characters on the table had, you know, as long as they had line of sight, range was no obstacle to them, and it made it pretty deadly for popping your head out. Classic example of this. So I had this character, what was his name again? Let's
The magician guy.
Malgorath the Voidbinder, the guy who looked like he was on his imaginary horse. So a really frail character, but he had that really powerful chain lightning spell. And I think the only remotely tactically impressive thing I did all game was keep him, you know, I negotiated him up to a position. You brought a few guys forward, quite exposed. And then I finally jumped out from behind this wall and tried to get this chain lightning spell away. And if it had all gone to plan, which it obviously didn't, that could have leapt from like, basically, there was the potential it could have wiped your entire warband out in yeah. one spell. He had a psych of 8. I rolled the D10. I only needed, you know, to not roll a 9 or a 10. I think I rolled a 9. Yeah. So he didn't get that spell away. Well, I was really looking forward to seeing that spell in action, just to see what happened. And then, of course, your guys just opened fire on him. And it, I can't remember what you rolled. It was like 3d6 plus 4 or something. You got you got this massive score, and my saving roll was 1d4 minus 1. So, like we were saying at the time, he basically had a shell suit on.
Yeah.
And he paid the price. So, yeah, that was another one of the big failures for me. I then had one of my other guys, Maro, he failed a break test after getting shot at. So, even though I had undead characters, they still got pretty spooked, didn't they?
Yeah. Aye, make no bones about it. He was offsky.
Yeah, Rictus. See yeah. you at the party, Rictus. That was one of my guys, so... but a good enjoyable scenario. And, again, the fact that I was, like, although the odds were so stacked against me at the end, in theory, I still could have won it because
yeah.
I could have got Scully down there against all odds. He wasn't that far away. And, you know, if he'd managed to throw your guy away, I had the throw ability, which I used a couple of times. So I could have won it. And that I think that's what you want in these games. Like, as much as one person might take a pound, and as long as you're not completely out the game, like, you could still get that, you know, 90th minute winner against all odds, so.
Yeah, and that keeps it balanced, because you don't want it to be like, no, I had 5 guys, you had 1, how could you kill them all in one go? That's ridiculous, what's the point? And it wasn't like that. And it also wasn't like, well, I'm down to 4, you've still got 5, I cannot win now.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way it's balanced. I like the fact that most of the characters had to roll a D10 and hit 4 or under to shoot. Because that meant, you know, more than half the time you were going to miss. And it just gave it a bit of longevity for that, if you like. And that combined with the fact that we only had potentially, and as it turned out, 5 turns to do it. There was no hanging about. But that with the aliens as well, you couldn't just hide behind cover. There's a job to do. There's a kind of a time limit. So it's kind of like speed chess in a way. You can't just rest on your laurels. You've got to go for it.
What did you think of the card-based system for activation as opposed to, like,
set order?
Yeah, if it was agility, then you end up knowing the order of it. And I found it really quite fun with the cards because there were a few situations. I mean, I talked about Scully getting into a fight with that alien.
Yeah.
And when it came into the new turn, if I'd drawn the Joker first, Scully could have been off the table. So it all came down to that, you know, is he going to activate before the alien? And I know this is more gamey and you know, I hate to use the term realistic in games like this with aliens and like zombies and stuff, but
yeah,
you know, the argument might be, well, the more agile character, it'd be more realistic if they went first. But I find this a bit more interesting because of the randomness of it.
Definitely, because otherwise, like, say my main chap, Mr. Jaquette, who's got the ability to be a tactician and give advice to another character to have a bonus to the next role. If Jaquette at the very beginning of the game had been determined to be last during each turn, he was basically going to be kind of useless with that ability, because there's no point me giving one of my other chaps a bonus when I don't even know what the board's going to look like until next turn. So that chance for Jake to maybe be first and have a really good view of the board, yeah, that works better. So that kind of that random aspect was, you know, it gives you many more possibilities, basically. Because otherwise, once you know the order of things, then you can kind of plan it out and think, well, that's going to be best. And it takes out the variability or the creativity, if you like.
And I think the sci-fi setting with guns, you know, projectiles, if you like, fancy projectiles, it's a lot more bloody than, like, we played the fantasy version the other week, and you're having to get up on, you know, on folks' faces and fight them hand to hand, and it takes a wee bit longer usually to kill somebody that way.
Yeah, do you know what? I definitely enjoyed the fact that it was more projectile based than melee, especially in some games where it does get muddied and big
you just
clumps.
End up with a pile.
Yeah, like Braveheart, there's just like 300 people and they're all just like slashing at each other in a big huddle.
Yeah.
Kind of like watching rugby, you know? So yeah, this was more fun for me, and it was quicker. It kept the game flowing better. I prefer this to the more melee-based games, I would say.
Yeah, I think one of my issues when that happens, and this game's pretty good for not overpowering or underpowering somebody if they're in this big clump amongst loads of enemies, but some games you do end up with, like, so there's a bonus for him, bonus for him, bonus for him, and then you're like, is this guy actually, is he involved or is he not? And you end up just, it's like, the amount of thought you have to give one of the roles takes you out the game and puts you back into, like, just, you know, scrambling for dice and doing sums in your head. So,
and the other thing was we never really had to worry about shooting into combat somebody that's already in combat, and if you're allowed to do that or not. And you know, that made it easier just to keep the game going as well. So yeah, I'm a big fan of this version of things.
Cool. Well, we'll maybe stick by the rule set for the next time. The sci-fi scenarios book, there's no shortage of interesting things to try in there to make sure you're doing something rather than just trying to kill one another. So,
and I would say the proof in the pudding as well is that we finished an hour earlier than last time. It was like 3 hours, and it was a tight 3 hours, and it's only been 2 hours this time, and that might be to a lot of people's preference, because you may not have 4 hours to get set up and play a game and record an amazing award-winning potentially podcast or whatever.
Yeah, and it's funny, the playing mat is much smaller than last time, maybe half the size.
Oh yeah.
But what I find is when you do the games on the big 4x4s, you do pretty much just end up with a concentration of troops in the same small area anyway, and
yeah,
you just end up with this huge, like, empty space around what's happening. So I know that some games you do need the big playing area, but I think for games like this, you maybe are better just going smaller, because
yeah,
it's all going to concentrate around that objective anyway.
Yeah, and it's tighter, and there's obviously a lot more terrain, certainly a lot more terrain per square inch or whatever to hide behind, and it's a bit more tactical. Tighter board, more terrain to hide, more thinking, the guns aspect. This has been great. This is probably one of my favourite ones, and not just because I won, but that did help.
I made you a coffee as well, so it's been a decent day for you.
It's been a great morning, absolutely has.
Well, always good to host you on the show, Robert. I'm sure the listeners will be happy, all three of them. So,
yep, thanks, guys.
There you go then. A game of Planet 28, a scenario from the sci-fi skirmish scenarios book as well. And I'm going to put photos of the game in a link in the show notes as well. So be sure to check out them if you want a wee look at the miniatures and the table and the setup and everything like that. On the painting table recently, something I've also put on the site is pictures of the Snotlands that I've been working on. So I had a bunch of Snotlands from the 90s, which I did a really bad job of back in the day. They were, you know how they came on a square base? I mean, they still do, depending on where you get them from. But if you turn the base around, you could see, it's like you're supposed to drill through the base and you can see clearly the little slots that they fit into. But being a kid at the time, I thought, well, you know, the bases of the Snotlands, it's like these little cylindrical, if I could say the word, slots that they go in. So I had turned the base the wrong way around, and I knew fine and well what way bases were supposed to go, but I had them glued in upside down, and then I think I just dipped the whole thing in sand. Like, I was a kid. I wasn't doing things very well, so they looked horrible. They looked terrible, and I found them years later, and I managed to rescue a lot of them, strip the paint off, get everything off them, and I've been gradually rebuilding them. So I've been working long term on a kind of goblin based war band, and I've got a lot of goblins from Nightmare Miniatures. I've also talked on the show about my Jareth miniature, David Bowie character, to lead them all, and it felt like a good time to add these Snotlands to the ranks as well. So I've got some large round bases, four large round bases, and I had a bunch of like 3D prints of fungus and mushrooms and stuff like that off Etsy, which I've also used in my Nurgle warband, especially around the Nurglen bases. So a very similar project here is to get these Snotlands ready. So I've got to the stage now where they're all based, you know, everything, all the scenery and terrain and that has been added on. They're like almost mini wee dioramas in themselves, and I'm at the stage now where they've had the Zenithal spray, so they're pretty much ready to paint whenever I get to them. So like I say, a link to the photos in the show notes as well of this episode, or you could go straight to bedroombattlefields.com. I've been painting my 15mm houses that I got from Alternative Armies, so I've completed two of those at time of recording. Really enjoyable. Again, the Zenithal prime for these, and I've been using the contrast paints and just a bit of light dry brushing as well. And I'm really happy with how they came up. I don't do a lot of terrain, don't paint a lot of terrain, but I feel like I'm always saying on this show that everything I paint is a nice wee palette cleanser. I'm not sure what I'm exactly cleansing my palette for constantly, but I would say that these houses have been a nice wee palette cleanser as well. So, like I say, the contrast paints come up really well on them, and just a nice light dry brush on some of the brickwork and that. So I'm happy with them. Looking forward to completing the set. I think there's five in total, so I'll gradually work my way through those. I also have a 15mm cannon for my good guy human army, which I've finished up. So bought the cannon, and I think the crew, I bought them separately, both on the Ral Partha site. I think they were Demon World miniatures. So again, a kind of multi-basing approach. I've got the crew and the cannon all on one square base. There's some cannonballs on there. There's like the box of probably gunpowder or whatever. And I'm really happy with how that's come up as well. And when I bought that on the Ral Partha site, I also come across this kind of, he's like a big pumpkin-headed sort of monster character. I suppose it would work in any scale, you know, 15, 28, whatever. But, well, right enough, I say 15, but it'd be a very big pumpkin if you did it in 15mm. So it's probably intended for 28. But he's a big kind of, I don't know, like he's been formed out of the parts of a farmer's field. Like, there seems like a couple of, like, agricultural blades on his back, and he's just all gnarly, like made of roots and stuff, and like I say, his head is a pumpkin. So pretty much a character intended for the kind of October period, which fortunately we're not in now at time of recording, it's March. But enjoyable. I was going to say palette cleanser, I'm going to stop saying that about things I've painted. So he's been added to the painted ranks recently. Just awaiting a wee coat of varnish. So next up for me is going to be finishing these houses, getting some paint on these Snotlands, and then I'm always going to have more 15 mil troops to paint as well. So I'm thinking of doing my human cavalry next, or one of the sets of archers for either the Orc and Goblin ranks or the humans. So I'll see. I'll take my pick at some point. But plenty to be getting on with on the 15 mil project. Elsewhere, we did a great episode, a question of the month episode in February around Warhammer the Old World. I really enjoyed listening back to the responses. It got a really good reception from the listeners as well. And the question of the month for March 2024 was around, you know, what hobby related thing have you changed your mind about? And in the middle of March, we've only actually had one response so far, so it's not going quite so well. Obviously, if we don't get a sufficient amount of responses, it's not really worth doing an episode about. So I don't know if that question's not quite hit the mark. Maybe you've had something in mind and you've just not got round to sending it in yet. But time's getting on, so I would really appreciate some responses on that front. bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, or find the link in the show notes to this episode, and you could send in your own thoughts on what hobby related thing that you've recently changed your mind about. Would really appreciate it if you did that. So on the gaming front then, we've obviously heard that wee report of the Planet 28 game that Robert and I recently played. Next time around, I'm going back into the fantasy genre. I was having a wee look at my miniatures the other day, and as much as I never buy modern GW stuff, I did like 3 or 4 years ago, I got the Chaos Marauders, which I thought were really cool miniatures. I still do. So bought them, painted them up, and I totally forgot about them, to be honest. But I was having a wee look over certain miniatures recently, and I thought it'd be cool to, you know, sometimes you see models and you think, God, you know, a story starts to formulate in your head. This is kind of what was going on there. So I've always been a fan of telling stories. You know, throughout my life, I've written a lot of fiction. As some of you might know, I've created a lot of audio drama as well, which I, you know, don't want to divert us, but I just don't get the time to do that these days. So building wee scenarios around miniatures and setting up stories, it's just a really good way to scratch that itch, that storytelling itch. So this is kind of what I'm looking at doing next. I thought, let's get these marauders having to do something here. They've got a captive. And I was thinking, well, we'll do some sort of a raid on a village. But then I was thinking, you know, I don't want to do this cliched, like, here come some Vikings or marauders and they're going to, you know, butcher everyone in this innocent village. I thought, why don't we make this village some sort of obscure, sinister, forgotten little outpost on the edge of the empire, where the villagers themselves are actually sort of chaos worshippers. And the reason for that, again, this goes back to one of the miniatures that I have available in my collection now. I've got this kind of Krell proxy, so he's like an undead chaos warrior. So I thought, maybe thousands of years ago, this famous chaos champion had died in the area and he was buried here. And this village has ended up being built around where he was buried. And it means that the villagers themselves have got, you know, if not sympathies to the chaos gods, then outright allegiance to them. And maybe celestially at this point in time, they're able to perform this ritual to try and raise this this chaos champion from his grave. So I thought to myself, let's give the villagers some sort of priest or shaman, and the marauders could be escorting, you know, their own kind of priest or shaman as well. So it's two competing warbands trying to complete this ritual to summon this chaos champion, and basically have them join their ranks for, you know, various different reasons, I suppose, that they want that to happen. So I'm thinking two captive miniatures at different corners of the table, and the priests, let's just call them the priests of each warband, standing next to them. So have each player roll a d6 at the end of each turn, or the start of each turn, and it's the first person that gets to 20 who has summoned the chaos champion. So looking at dice averages, 6 rolls of a d6, you'll be hitting about 21. So obviously a player could roll really well and get there quite quick, or they could roll really badly and not get there at all. But you know, the first player to get there, that's the point in the game where this Chaos Champion miniature appears on the tabletop. And then you could have other dynamics as well. You know, maybe that automatically means he joins their side. Maybe you still need to roll off and he could actually join the other side. Maybe he could become an NPC and, you know, be essentially fighting both sides as well. So there's lots of opportunities there to see what we could do with that. I'm thinking of using Song of Blades and Heroes in order to, you know, I'm really wanting to strip back the rules of the game to really let the story come to the forefront here. I'm looking at event cards, leaning on the sort of Rangers of Shadowdeep style event card deck. I want to create some of them and just have, you know, lots of possibilities for twists and turns. Just to really, really tell quite an immersive story around this. Of course, the tricky part with event cards, you know, if you're going for that like event deck or clue deck style of play seen in Rangers of Shadowdeep, the tricky part of marrying that up with Song of Blades and Heroes is that the turn transition is pretty volatile, because if you've played the game before, you'll know that characters have a quality score, and depending on your role, you know, you might get one, two, three activations, or you might lose your turn entirely. And that means it's very hard to predict how many event cards would be. You know, if we're talking about each time the turn transitions, we'll pull an event card out, you could actually, you know, you could be flirting back between turns pretty quickly. So it's hard to predict how many cards you'd need. Obviously, you'd need to have some filler cards in there where just nothing happens, because you don't want, like, you know, one turn the weather goes this way, the next turn here comes this random monster, etc., etc. That would just get too hard to keep up with and a bit too silly. So I'm still trying to figure out a way around that, whether that means just taking out the turn transition, you know, the quality roll thing. There are ways around it. You know, I've played enough of these wee skirmish games that you can kind of almost build one up with like a hodgepodge. You know, maybe I take this from Song of Blades and Heroes. I like the idea of using the movement sticks rather than the measuring tape. The very simple combat mechanics there. But maybe I'll pull some stuff from Brutal Quest, Open Combat, Frostgrave itself, you know, who knows, I'll put some together. But really the main intention is on the story, the events, the scenario and the objectives and stuff like that. Our question of the month for April 2024 is, have you ever tried to convince a 40k or Age of Sigmar player to play a non-GW miniatures game? If so, what was the response? What game did you play? And crucially, did they enjoy it? I'd love to hear about your own experiences on this front, and you could record your audio feedback by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now, back to the show. So elsewhere, a couple of wee random ideas that I was toying with recently. This is one of the typical like moments of inspiration you get when you've got a kid and, you know, you're either reading something or they're watching something on the TV or whatever. But my wee girl, she's really into the Julia Donaldson books. It's like the Gruffalo and Zog the Dragon and everything. But there's one called Room on the Broom. You're maybe familiar with it if you've got kids at a similar age. But she had that on in the telly, and it was, you know, the witch on the broomsticks fighting this dragon. And I don't know why this idea manifested here, because I've seen like all the Game of Thrones and everything, which are packed full of dragons. But I just got thinking, like a dragon combat game, you know, an aerial dragon combat game, that'd be a really cool idea, wouldn't it? Because I know that you've got games like, is it Blood Red Skies, Andy Chambers' game, and it's World War II aeroplanes, but what if you just took a rule set like that and got some dragon miniatures and, you know, had an aerial combat game between dragons? Maybe that does exist. If it does, please let me know about it. But on the other hand, I really don't need to be buying new miniatures and getting distracted with a completely new project as well. I don't even know what sort of, you know, what scale would you use for that? Would you just use your sort of standard 28 mil dragon, probably with a guy on the back? Would you be able to find dragons that looked more like they were in flight and at a smaller scale as well? I think you'd probably need to scale down a bit. So I don't know, maybe a 6 to 10 or 15 mil dragon that you could, like I say, have more visually like they were in flight rather than on the ground. So just a half-baked, not even half-baked idea that I wanted to, I suppose, just say out loud to get it off my chest. And another such idea, I've had this for a couple of years now. I've been thinking about Under the Sea as a setting for a miniatures game. And I have seen in the Miniature War Games magazine, I've seen a few examples of this. But from what I could remember, it was more like, I think there was James Bond style settings, and also Stingray, I'm sure it was. You know, Stingray, the puppet show for back in the day. And what I had in mind was more of a Lovecraftian setting. You know, maybe even going down the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea route. But, you know, quite a grim or gothic setting under the sea. Those old school diving suits. And, you know, you've got Rulli and Cthulhu and all the stuff that Lovecraft put in the ocean that you've got to play with. So I think you'd have not only a really cool aesthetic there, but great opportunities, again, to tell stories and for thematic and unusual mechanics as well. Again, maybe this does exist already. But again, stuff like this requires a lot of new, probably conversions, a lot of new painting styles, a lot of new types of terrain. And it's a whole different project on my own. And new projects definitely aren't something I'm seeking out at the moment, if ever. But just an idea that I can't kind of shake. You know, I always keep coming back to turning it over in my head. So undersea stuff, you know, the whole Lovecraft vibe, I think there's definitely a lot of potential there. One final idea that I'm going to throw out there and do absolutely nothing with, in all likelihood, is the setting of Titan, which some of you might know is the biggest moon of Saturn. This is a place that I've been fascinated with since the landing of the Huygens probe in 2005. And it's such a fascinating world because it's straight out of science fiction, but, you know, it's literally real. But it's just almost inaccessible for us at the moment. We have obviously, I say we as in humanity, has put the Huygens probe on there. We've got some very grainy images of the place. And I believe the next mission to Titan, obviously unmanned, but that launches in 2028, and I think it gets there in 2034. So Titan, if you're not aware of it already, is the only it's not a planet, literally, it's a moon, but it's the only place with an atmosphere in our solar system that we know of. I'm pretty confident of that, correct me if I'm wrong. But instead of the atmosphere that we have here on Earth, you know, on Titan, you've got hydrocarbon lakes and seas instead. And the biggest one of those hydrocarbon oceans is called Kraken Mare. And I've been fascinated with that for a long time. Just the thought that you could have this big sea, but it's not water. It's like oils and chemicals and stuff like that. You know, the whole place has got this orange glow to it, this thick, cloudy atmosphere. You know, there's a chance that you might be able to see Saturn in the horizon, and, you know, it's rings and stuff like that. So it's just a visually just a really fascinating place. It's not impossible that there might be some weird life as we don't know it, life forms there, you know, but we just don't know at this stage. So really cool place. And again, fantastic potential for a miniatures game, in my opinion. But on that note, like I did mention earlier on about writing fiction and creating audio drama and stuff like that, and I did actually create an audio drama, a short story audio drama set on Titan. I made this back in 2015, so scarily it's like not a kick in the nuts off 10 years old, but I think this is probably the best audio drama piece that I ever made. And although this show is not about audio drama or fiction or anything like that, just because I'd been talking about it recently, thinking about it recently and talking about it as a great setting for a miniatures game. And Robert's been on the show today and he's in this because we worked together on a lot of audio drama. I thought I'd just play us out with that. So if you're interested in it, here's an audio drama story set on Titan called Kraken Mary.
This is Jameson.
Coming, Captain.
I can confirm we successfully entered the atmosphere of Titan at mission time 1173-851. We are approaching 250 feet from the surface. Chutes were deployed at 3,000 feet.
Copy that. How's your visibility?
We're currently penetrating a thick cloud level. It's pretty dense. No view of the surface just yet.
It'll make Edinburgh look like Bermuda down there.
Aye, well, the captain would get sunburned reading a holiday brochure. That'll suit him just fine.
Well, at least I'll be the only human being setting foot on Titan who still has a head of hair, McGovern.
Well, hopefully you'll keep hold of it once we discover what's lying down there.
Visibility improving now, Butler. We are through most of this cloud layer.
How's it looking?
The lighting isn't great, but we're getting a pretty clear view of the landscape. The Sea of Kraken Mare is spread out to our left. I can see a mountain range off to our right.
Looks like we'll be landing between 500 and 800 yards from the coastline.
The sky is heavy. Those methane clouds are dark and brooding. The whole landscape has a rusty orange tinge to it.
Do you have a surface temperature reading?
Minus 161 degrees Celsius, Butler. And that's a balmy minus 251 degrees Fahrenheit.
Better get the fur coats looked out.
Indeed. Okay, Butler, we better get strapped in for landing. We'll report back once we're safely on the surface.
Copy that. Good luck.
Cheers. Welcome to Titan.
History has been made today as the first manned mission to Titan reportedly touched down just a few hours ago. The expedition won the race to reach the mysterious moon orbiting Saturn ahead of countless others, including NASA. Their mission, funded by British entrepreneur Jennifer Barry, is to investigate what appears to be some kind of wreckage on the floor of the moon's biggest methane ocean, Kraken Mare. The discovery was made by the Wells Dyson satellite almost 9 years ago and sparked a frantic space race that might finally answer one of humanity's biggest unanswered questions. Are we alone in the universe? Barry's team is made up of only 3 astronauts, Scotsman Frank Jameson and Duncan McGovern, who will conduct the groundwork on Titan, and London-born Dr. Laura Butler, who will man the control ship from the moon's orbit. The mission, which took just over 2 years to reach Titan, had been criticized by NASA as being rushed, careless, and grossly undermanned. But as news reached Earth that her accelerated expedition program appears to have paid off, Barry hit back at the space agency, who don't launch their own flight to Titan until February next year.
The pensioners at NASA need about 4 years of budget meetings just to organize a night out at the cinema, don't they? I think we've all been dreadfully excited about that object on the floor of the sea on Titan. It's really captured the imagination of the whole world. I've been fascinated by the prospect of life on other planets since I was a little girl, so money was no object when I put together this mission. To suggest that it was rushed and understaffed is ludicrous. Our 3 astronauts are the most capable, competent and skilled individuals I've ever met. Sometimes bigger isn't always better. When the Americans finally get there, we'll already have built a hotel to put them up in.
From this moment, the entire human race holds its breath in anticipation. The team now face the daunting task of diving down 160 meters to the bottom of this freezing methane ocean to investigate the object, which is said to be about the size of a Chinook helicopter. But Barry insists that with her equipment and training, this should be a routine mission.
Microsub ready to roll, Captain. I'll get a start in calibrating that reverse fuel cell.
Good work. I've got your suit ready.
Glad I'm finally somewhere cold enough to wear the bloody thing. I nearly melted away to a puddle the last time I had it on.
Well, you'll be thankful for it once you're outside and under the surface. If you so much as dipped your big toe in that stuff without it, you'd be dead in minutes.
And there was me about to get the Speedos on.
Christ, what a sight that would have been.
I'd have looked like David Hasselhoff jogging into the Pacific on Baywatch.
Aye, nipples harder than diamonds and a scrotum the size of a walnut.
The perfect image to greet some extraterrestrial life for me.
Well, like I've always said, if something or someone crashed that thing, they'll be doing incredibly well to be staying alive down there. Especially if it's been sitting there for 10 million years.
Just as long as I don't have to give anything the kiss of life.
Please don't. If it wakes up and phones home, you can bet Earth would be obliterated before we even got you back to the surface.
Huh. You need a hand with it?
Well, this? Nah, I'm done. Come on. Let's go and get the Land Rover set up.
Okay, Captain. Coordinates from the landing point are uploading to the Land Rover interface now. That will give you the closest point from the shoreline to the objective.
Good work, Butler. Everything running smoothly down here, all equipment serviced and ready to go. We'll be bedding down for the night in an hour or so.
Technically, the night isn't for another 10 days, Captain.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I brought enough coffee to fully adjust a Titan cycle just yet. Let's stick with good old GMT for now.
How's McGovern?
He's fine. I can tell he's nervous, but who wouldn't be?
It's a fairly straightforward route from the coast, 432 metres in, 148 metres down. I suppose that's easy for me to say, sitting up here.
He practically lived in that micro-sub for 8 months before we left Earth. He'll be just fine.
I know. Anyway, if you need anything else before tomorrow, just shout. I'll let you get some rest. Good night, Captain.
Night, Butler.
What's that you're reading?
Trainspotting.
Irvin Welsh, eh? That's an old one.
Aye. Reminds me of home, though.
Missing it, eh?
Missing the wife and the wee man. And the cat.
It's not easy.
I know we have a laugh and a joke, but think about where we are right now. Where we actually are right now.
You're having your moment of clarity, then.
Yeah, that moment when you lie back and think, here I am, lying in bed, reading a book about two men sitting in a pub in Edinburgh. And I'm on Titan. Fucking Titan.
Incredible, I know. Funny you should say that about your book, too.
What do you mean?
Well, think about it. You said you're reading about people living everyday lives in Edinburgh. When that book was written, I bet most people read sci-fi books about space travel to places like Titan.
Huh, suppose you're right. They read about us reading about them.
Well, I'm going to get some sleep. Tomorrow, we'll certainly be giving the folks on Earth plenty to read about.
We sure will.
Night, McGovern. And don't you be up all night reading.
Night, Captain. Just one more chapter.
You sound like my daughter.
McGovern to command. Lonely night up there, was it?
Lonely? No way. It was great to get some peace and quiet.
Rubbish. You missed yourself anyway.
Yeah?
Yep. Jameson threw a huge party. The Titan police came and told us to turn the music down.
Hmm. You're such a rebel. Ready for the big plunge, then?
Sure am. Snug as a bug in this aqua armour. Jameson's been off collecting samples from the ground around the module.
Don't listen to him, Butler. I was busy cleaning up the mess from this party that we allegedly had last night. You fit and ready, McGovern?
Raring to go, Captain.
Hop on then, I'll drive. Butler, we'll check back with you once we reach the coast.
Copy that. Hope you remembered your fishing rods.
Cracking mare, eh? She's a fair old size. I can't even see the other side. Not that I can see very far in any direction in this bloody place.
5 times the size of Lake Superior, to be exact, or if you want a Scottish comparison, nearly 1,500 times the size of Loch Ness.
Well, I suppose unlike Loch Ness, at least we know for sure there's something down there.
I guess we'll find out for sure soon enough, eh? Come on, let's get this micro-sub disconnected.
Upon their arrival on the shores of Kraken Mare, one member of Barry's team, Edinburgh-born astronaut and deep-sea diver Duncan McGovern, will board and operate a tiny one-person submarine known as a microsub down into the depths of this freezing ocean of liquid methane.
The microsub is one of the finest bits of kit in our arsenal. It's a one-man craft and looks a bit like an egg lying on its side. We wanted it to be as small as possible so we could get close to and even inside anything we might find down there. It was custom built not as a water submersible, but specifically to dive in liquid methane. As an operator, Mr. McGovern is exceptionally skilled. He took a prototype model down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench 3 years ago. Whatever it is lying under Kraken Mare, you can be sure he'll find it. Though liquid methane can be a clear substance, the heavy clouds on Titan mean visibility will be rather poor. The microsub has state-of-the-art infrared cameras on every side, however, so as far as Mr. McGovern is concerned, it'll be like scuba diving in the shallows of the Caribbean.
I'm approaching a depth of 100 metres below surface level. Visibility remains good. No noticeable current down here either. Very still.
Aye, the waves are barely 2 centimetres high. I doubt this will become a space tourist destination for surfers in the future.
Never say never, Captain. If Barry wants that, she'll make it happen.
Your temperature has dropped a bit. How are you feeling?
A bit colder, yeah. Didn't think that would be possible in this gear.
Well, you are further away from the sun now than any human's ever been in history.
Don't I know it?
Temperature is stable again. We'll need to keep an eye on it, though.
Objective is now visible. I'm 30 metres from the seabed.
Have you got a decent view of it yet?
Not much better than the satellite images so far, but getting closer. I'm going to lock on now.
McGovern?
I've locked onto the objective. 15 metres from seabed.
Is everything okay? I've lost your picture.
I heard a bit of feedback when I locked on. Maybe we're picking up some sort of static, or maybe it's the methane.
Well, I've only got radio communication with you at the moment. Can you try locking off again?
Copy. How's that?
Still nothing.
My cameras are still picking everything up. Must just be a signal issue. Don't worry, Captain. You'll see it all once I'm back up there. 2 meters above seabed and stabilizing. Christ, it's cold.
Well, that's far from ideal, the picture and the temperature.
I guess it's just my punishment for having all the fun.
Well, I don't like it. Maybe we should abort.
Oh, hell no. Captain, I'm fine, honestly. It's just a minor feedback issue. You're not jealous, are you? I'm heading towards objective now. The seabed is more uneven than we'd anticipated. There's some rock faces and plateaus to our left and behind.
How's your visibility?
Good. Tell you what, Captain. There's some big caves down here. Might be worth another trip or two later in the week.
One thing at a time, McGovern. McGovern?
Sorry, Captain. I'm approaching the objective and...
What is it? Come on, talk to me.
It's like nothing I've ever seen. Honestly, you wouldn't believe it.
Is everything all right?
Everything's fine. Better than fine. This is just incredible.
Well, spill the beans then. For the love of God, is it some sort of...
craft? Yeah. It's a spacecraft for sure, Captain.
It's about the size of a house, made of a kind of almost rocky-looking material. I can't identify it. Maybe it's a build-up of sediment or some other localized environmental effect.
Can you get close enough to take a sample? Even a scraping?
I'm just heading round to the... Oh, bloody hell!
What? Oh, will you stop doing that? I can't see anything!
You'll not believe this, Captain. There's a huge tear in the wall of the thing. I think something must have shot it down.
Come on now, McGovern. That's wild speculation. It's more than likely just crash impact damage.
At this gravity, I don't think so. The craft was almost certainly attacked. There's more damage right across this side.
Just keep documenting it and leave the analysis till later. 5 seconds into discovering that we're not alone in the universe, now we're fantasizing about more extraterrestrial races.
Why would it have to be another race who attacked them? We've managed just fine fitting amongst ourselves on Earth all these years.
I was hoping we'd find proof of other life forms who weren't a pile of bastards like us, though.
I think I might be able to get inside.
Inside? You mean the...
The craft, yeah. The hole in the side is easily big enough.
Are you sure?
Let's get a closer look.
This is amazing.
Is there anything... anyone in there?
The equipment is like nothing I've ever seen before. There's some sort of control panel straight in front of me. I'm guessing that's where they flew the thing from.
You're still filming it all, right?
Are you kidding? I'll get 100 billion hits on YouTube for this.
YouTube? What age are you?
It's making a comeback.
My granddad said that about Facebook for years.
I think I see... Holy fuck!
What?
There's two bodies over here, at the far end of this chamber.
What kind of bodies? Physical bodies, corpses.
Hold on, let me get a bit closer. Would you look at that?
Well, I can't, can I? What is it?
Remember when we were doing our physicals at the Institute? There was that really tall guy with the big nose and comb over?
Hey?
Big skinny guy. Looked like someone had put a suit on a flagpole.
McGovern, what the hell is this?
Well, if he had had sex with an ant, These guys would be their kids.
Hardly Neil Armstrong's one giant step spiel, is it? I thank Christ we're not broadcasting directly back to Earth. Have you got a sensible, or dare I say it, a scientific description of these beings?
I'd say about 8 to 10 feet tall. Humanoid. Leathery or rubbery textured suits, or skin. But I'm sure it's suits. No sign of mouths or eyes. But I'm sure those aren't helmets.
Can you get one back up with you?
I could, but what if the methane's preserving them? You said yourself this might have been here for millennia.
I suppose you're right. We can come back tomorrow with one of the airlock capsules.
Some of the controls on this side look a bit like sonar equipment. There doesn't appear to be any windows either.
I suppose if you don't have eyes, you don't need windows.
Good shout. I never thought of that.
Does it look like they navigated with any sort of big screens, computers, consoles, that sort of thing?
There's no obvious signs of anything like that. Something is troubling me a wee bit though, Captain.
What's that?
I'm not entirely sure that this was a spacecraft.
Well, what else could it have been, McGovern? I mean, everything you've described suggests that it...
I think it might have been a submersible.
A submarine? But you said it had been attacked from the outside.
What the hell was that?
McGovern, what's going on? I'm seeing a lot of movement on the surface.
I'm not hanging around to find out. I'm on my way back.
Hurry, the surface is getting really choppy now.
I'm approaching the exit. There's a strong current down here. I'm having to fight with the controls.
How quickly can you...
Oh no.
What is it? Have you...
Caves. But there's...
McGovern! McGovern, do you copy? McGovern, do you copy? McGovern, God damn it, get up here now!
Surviving member of the team, Dr. Laura Butler, faces a long and lonely trip back to Earth. Butler herself had not set foot on Titan and could only listen on in horror as her comrades met their grisly fate. Yesterday, she sent an emotional message back to her friends, family, and the rest of us here on Earth.
We knew the risks when we signed up for the mission. The guys knew the risks of landing on Titan. The discoveries they made in their short time down there have dwarfed the other significant discoveries of mankind. What we discovered on Titan changes everything. We discovered that we are not alone in the universe, that there exists or has existed another form of intelligent life, a species with superior technology and an obvious curiosity for space exploration. But I believe we discovered something else, something ancient and terrible. Though this creature's ferocity, strength, and size is unrivaled on Earth, I think we can console ourselves that it doesn't present any immediate danger to us, unless we should return to its home. For anyone else that heads to that cold, forbidding world, God help them. Way back in 2008, When scientists named the frigid, bleak ocean of Kraken Mare after a mythical sea monster, they were closer than they could have ever imagined. Chillingly close.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.